came to America when he was 6 months old. He started as a stock boy at the grocery store. Eventually, he owned it. He turned it into the biggest grocery store chain in New York City. He now owns a real estate company worth over $2 billion. He ran for mayor of New York City. He almost won. You can't make this story up. This is the Katz Roundtable with John Catsimatidis.
Everywhere around the world, they come to America.
Good morning, New York. This is the Katz Roundtable, John Catsimatidis, here Sunday morning. What a bunch of stories we have for you today. Governor David Patterson, along with Congressman Peter King. We have Joe Connor. His father died while working at CCNY, and they named the building after the killer. NYPD John Schell, an update on what happened with the clean out of Columbia and NYU. Steve Cates, Dr. Sky. Donald Klavan, supervisor of Hempstead, the largest town in the United States, mad as heck about congestion pricing. Vito Fisella, let's start off with Michael Stoller, a briefing on what's going on in the real estate industry.
Good morning. This is Mike Stoller for the Stoller Real Estate Report on the Katz Roundtable.
What's happening in the office market today in New York City? I don't know the answer, so I brought together today Brett Shannon, who is the Senior Vice President of the CBRE Group and the Agency Group business, correct?
That's right, and that's CBRE Agency Group.
CBRE Agency Group. So tell me what the Agency Group is.
Sure. The Agency Group at CBRE in New York, a group of about 10 professionals that specifically focuses on representing landlords in New York City in the leasing market with a special focus on larger scale repositionings, lease strategies. So rather than being engaged to represent a building that may have one or two suites or floorable, we're typically engaged to help formulate strategies for anchor tenant lease-ups, major renewal negotiations, new construction design, redevelopment design and strategy. It's a fascinating place to be because we get to work with a lot of incredible real estate professionals in their own right as our clients.
Both as owners and as tenants, correct?
Yeah, we primarily focus on ownership representation, but there's no doubt the engagement that we have with those anchor-sized tenants within New York City is an interesting sort of lens into the overall market.
So which is the best market today? Are we talking Hudson Yards for the pricing?
Yeah.
As an owner-landlord, or is it, Midtown Manhattan?
Yeah, I think what's fascinating about the market right now is just how bifurcated it is. Obviously, you see a lot of sort of doomsday headlines that are focused on macro trends. Oftentimes, they don't capture what's really happening on the street within the market. And so, for example, I think the core of Midtown right now is the strongest it's been in my career. I've been around CB since 2009, but in particular, Park Avenue, near Grand Central, core locations are performing the best they ever have. There's more demand for that space than there's been, and we're seeing real increase in rental rates as a result.
So what are the rental rates in the Park Avenue?
Yeah, depending on the product, they're well into the triple digits, right? So at new construction like One Vanderbilt or 425 Park Avenue, buildings that were delivered since 2021, they're now achieving rents in excess of $200 per square foot. The average asking rent in Midtown right now is about $80 a foot. So it gives you a sense of just how much runway those buildings have had, the scale of the demand, the profile of tenant to which they appeal. But even the typical older existing stock that's been renovated and repositioned along Park Avenue, Madison Avenue, Fifth Avenue, they're all seeing healthy rents well into the triple digits.
Is it an opportunity for a tenant in this market?
It's an opportunity to potentially secure the space that brings your employees back to work.
So what is it going to secure the space to bring the employees back to work?
Yeah, so I think what we've seen is going into the pandemic, there was what we'd call a flattening of geography around Manhattan, where tenants were primarily focused on attracting the best product, and they didn't care quite as much about the location where that office was. What we've seen is coming out of the pandemic, and in particular when you're competing with work from home, having what they call a one-seat commute and making it as easy as possible to get to work for talent, and then allowing that talent to go work in the best buildings and environments is really what it's taking to attract the employee base that the most discerning companies want. And I think along with that sort of shift in demand back to core Midtown, what we've seen is in the pre-pandemic market, much of the office market was being driven by big tech in a low interest rate environment that was focused on headcount growth and expansion and a certain type of product. And what we found is the tenants coming out of the pandemic with the strongest return to work metrics are the more traditional industries, in particular private financial services, banks, law firms. And those are the companies now that are the most active in the market and are competing to secure the highest quality space. And a lot of it is about attracting and retaining talent and providing the best environment for their employees to work in.
What about Hudson Yards? I want to talk about specifically the related properties and the other properties in the neighborhood, including Brookfield's.
So I think if you look at, so Manhattan West is Brookfield's campus on the far west side. That's primarily anchored by new construction towers, and that's just slightly east of Related's far west side, Hudson Yards, right? Both of those projects have been extraordinarily successful, and it's a testament to the quality of the product that they delivered. And if you looked at the tenant rosters that they've attracted, you know, the most recent building to deliver over at Manhattan West, to Manhattan West, it's a combination of KPMG, D.E. Shaw, Clifford Chance, Cravath, right? It's an incredible roster of clients that I think speaks to the, tenants that I think speaks to the quality of what they provided. But what's interesting to me about the success that those buildings have had and certainly the rental rates that they've achieved is if you also look at the capital markets landscape going forward, we're in an environment right now where it's really hard to justify building and being able to achieve the rents required to break even on new construction delivery. So the pipeline of new construction within Manhattan, which had been really strong from 2013 going forward, right? You had delivery of the World Trade Center and millions of square feet downtown. You had delivery of Hudson Yards. You had delivery of Manhattan West, One Vanderbilt, and other major projects like that is virtually dry right now. There's no pipeline at all for new construction going forward. And so everything that was delivered in recent years has been spoken for by the highest quality tenants.
I wish we had more time to talk. We'll maybe have you in the future. I'd like to thank Brett for being here. See you next week.
Thanks very much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Cats Roundtable. We'll be right back right after this break. Welcome back to the Cats Roundtable. With us this morning is Governor David Patterson. Governor Patterson, what is your common sense for this week?
Well, for this week, I really want to examine that some of the guests on the 5 o'clock show and others have been comparing what went on at Columbia, the occupation, to what happened in 1968. And these are two very different situations. In 1968, those students were protesting the war in Vietnam, racial relations, segregation issues. In other words, they had real causes that even people who disagreed with them understood that that was a good debate. And they were much different in the sense that Jerry Nadler, who is now a congressman for that area and many others, he did not support the occupation of Hamilton Hall at that time, and he didn't support it this time. In this particular situation, the occupation started out very nonviolent. The encampment, you know, was obviously a little intimidating, but it wasn't bothering people. But what happened was we now know that 40 to 50% of the individuals involved didn't even attend Columbia and had no relationship with that campus other than to become outside agitators. At that point, when the police came in 1968, they just used excessive force. There were a lot of hospitalizations. It was not done well at all. This time, I can't believe that the police are getting any criticism because what they did, and this is what you have to do in law enforcement situations, You don't just walk in like you have three people from Law and Order and say, all right, everybody, get out of here. You have to show the intimidating force that is available if needed. And that's why they sent those tanks in. It scared a lot of people, but the arrests were made. Nobody was seriously hurt, and they cleared the campus. And that's the way it should have gone. And I think Mayor Adams and the members of the police department should be commended for handling that situation as well as they did.
They did a great job. And that's what a commander or what a CEO is supposed to do. And the Columbia CEO should have done that sooner, in my opinion.
I think that that's absolutely right. That we talked about this last week, that there's too much of a hesitation in those types of situations. And the adversary, who in this case were the students and the non-students who were involved in the protest, I'm getting the feeling that the issues that they were raising were not even what was most important to them. What was most important to them was destabilizing government, destabilizing the educational facility, and turning people against each other, while all along their basic goal is to just create disruption. And that can't be allowed anywhere.
And there's a big controversy around, and nobody really knows the real numbers. How many of the people protesting were students, and how many were outside agitators? And I just like your opinion, because
are that about 35% of the Columbia protesters were outside agitators. At City College, it's estimated that it was 60 to 65%. So when you balance it out, about 50% of the protesters at these two institutions, and probably at NYU as well, were people who were coming from the outside, taking advantage of a situation. And that's how they got the students to take over Hamilton Hall. When a lot of the students, they liked being at the encampment, but they weren't there to create violence. But you know what happens, it's like a mob mentality. When everybody starts doing something, too many people follow them. And in this particular case, people who have started riots in other places know how to whip up a crowd. We saw that on January 6th, and we saw it at Columbia. Different points of view, same hoodlum behavior.
It looks like it's over. Governors and the mayors have and the supervisors of various towns have taken the lead and say enough is enough. Do you think it's over?
I think for the time being it's over, because the school year is closing and it really started really on school campuses. But I think that in the coming months, we've got to examine what was really going on there, because I thought a lot of the protesting was anti-Semitic. And it seems to be pushed to the background with, you know, who is on campus and who shouldn't be on campus and taking over buildings. But that issue, which I think was the primary issue that evolved out of what happened on October 7th of last year, really isn't being talked about. And this idea, we're for the Palestinians. Well, who are the Palestinians? Obviously, there are a lot of people who are poor and are starving and are in bad shape. But the fact is that they didn't get that way because necessarily of anything that the state of Israel did, but it was the response to people that they know who attacked the state of Israel.
Governor Patterson, thank you so much for coming on this Sunday morning, and we'll see you real soon.
Thank you, John. Take care.
The Cats Roundtable.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
With us today is former Congressman Peter King, and a lot of things happening in our city, especially what's going on in our universities. Congressman King, what do you think is going on? Where are all these people coming from? How can
John?
Yes.
Go ahead. No, you finish.
I was going to say one more thing. How can 200 agitators, or whether they're students or whether they're outsiders, take the entire Columbia University and turn it upside down?
John, this whole situation is a disgrace. I agree with you. It's a small number of people, but they're effectively organized. I think it's a combination of radical students, but also agitators, planners from the outside who have been doing this for a number of years at different issues. Now they're focused on this one, and they're combining with anti-Semitism. But no, it cannot be done without the outside agitators. Those tents, I mean, that was like a tent city was set there. The expense of that, the cost of that, all the materials that were involved, the organizing. And even like the night when the police came in, you could see these adults, old, you know, middle-aged people giving signals and advice to the demonstrators. And so I think it's a combination of many, many outside agitators, too many confused students, left-wing students. But I'm so proud of the job the NYPD did. Some people thought they sent in too many cops. No, I think they wanted to have overwhelming force to make sure that nobody, that the situation cannot get out of hand. They basically surrounded every element of the campus. There was going to be no exit or entrance. There's going to be no disturbances starting in random parts of the campus. They wanted the whole thing under control when they went into that hall to clear it out. But it was it shouldn't have gone on that long. I don't know what's wrong with educators today. John, you know, when you were in college or I was in college, this would not be tolerated at all. It's one thing between peaceful demonstrations, dissents, but to be taking over a university, to be destroying property, to be smashing windows, to be hurling anti-Semitic insults and threatening Jewish students, this reminds me more of Germany in the 1930s than America. This is wrong. So thank God the cops did the job. They got it over with quickly and effectively after days and days of people saying nothing could be done. Once the NYPD got the word, they went in, they took care of it. Massive show of force. They got it done, and they have to now make sure that this is never allowed to happen again. Other universities are having it, NYU. I see Fordham is having troubles. We saw UCLA the other day. This is, John, the country is going in the wrong direction. You always say, what the heck is going on? I think there's a lot of bad things going on, and there's a lack of common sense, and there's a lack of basic patriotism.
Absolutely. How can we allow people that will never become citizens or should never become citizens if they have green cards that say they hate America? Whether they're migrants or they have green cards and they hate America, what are they doing here? Let them go someplace else.
Absolutely. John, the immigrants of previous generations were so proud to be here, so happy. They would kiss the ground and they loved America. They became more American than the Americans. I mean, there was, to me, nobody was prouder to be an American than immigrants. They love being here. Now they come here and they get everything. By the way, the immigrants in those days got nothing. They came in here. They were just happy to be here and be able to work hard for a living. Now, you know, they get credit cards, they get food, they get Ubers, they get bikes, they get everything. And so many in the schools, these students are foreign students. Some of these universities, almost half their student body are foreigners, you know, here on green cards. They should be immediately deported, absolutely out the door the next day if they take part in any of these demonstrations. And we should have some kind of a screening. If somebody is overtly anti-Semitic, anti-American, what are universities doing letting them come in if they're, you know, not even citizens to begin with?
When kids are getting student visas, I think somebody should check them out before you let them in. I mean, it's just mind-boggling these days.
It really is. And the abuse they show for the police and also anti-Semitism, you know, it's always been around to some extent. It obviously reached a vicious peak during the Hitler years in the 30s and the 40s. But I think most of us thought that was, for the most part, way behind us. There was always going to be a small undercurrent. But to see now, I mean, all these remarks about the Jews attacking them and praising Hamas, praising the Palestinians. I mean, Hamas is anti-gay, anti-Christian, anti-Semitic, anti-American. And to have young students being educated in the United States, pledging allegiance, basically, putting up the Hamas flag. That's why up at City College or City University now, I was so happy to have Mayor Adams, when he directed the NYPD, to take down the Hamas flag and put up the American flag. But it's sad when you think that New York City ended up looking like Iwo Jima. We have, you know, two heroic cops putting up the flag like the Marines at Iwo Jima. I mean, it's like we're being overtaken by a foreign power, and it's coming from within. That's really terrible.
Where are we going? Where are we going with this, Congressman? I don't think we're going to solve the college problem until we solve the border problem.
This week, I was at a briefing. It was not a top-level security briefing, but it was people very familiar with domestic terrorism, people in federal and local law enforcement. And they were talking about how dangerous the open border is. Remember, we spent the last 20 years, everybody had to be stopped at the airport. You had to go through magnetometers. You had to be checked for the thought that one or two people may be sneaking in from overseas. Now you have thousands of them, thousands, tens of thousands just streaming across the border. And we know that many of them have been on the terrorist watch list. We know that many of them come from countries which have a history of anti-American and Islamist terrorism. So, no, these are fearful times, John, and I just think that we have to start talking common sense, stop pandering to different groups. I mean, Joe Biden should not be worried about the Arab population in Michigan or Minnesota or wherever he's concerned about, Pennsylvania. The thing is, he should be focused on what's good for America. President Trump has to find a way to really intelligently address this whole issue of immigration. We have to make it clear that we support immigration, but with tight restrictions on who's coming in, and we have to secure that southern border. If you're an American running for president, if you want to be president of this country, you have to have secure borders. Otherwise, we're not a country.
Congressman King, thank you for your input. Common sense has to prevail. Otherwise, our country's going to have a problem. Thank you so much.
Hey, John, I'll see you tomorrow night on Cats and Cosby.
You are listening to the Cats Roundtable. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Cats Roundtable. And with us today is Chief of Patrol John Schell. Chief, give us a description. What was going on? I watched it on television, and it looked like a lot of havoc.
It was a very long night dealing with Columbia University and City College. Both schools gave us a letter stating what they wanted. They wanted the encampments removed, and in Columbia's case, they wanted the Hamilton House back. We put together a very strategic layered plan with hundreds of cops. We arrested 282 people. We cleared both campuses and secured both campuses. There were no incidents whatsoever. We got the Hamilton building back. It was very chaotic. A lot of moving parts, but our department, our young cops, everyone performed quite well.
Well, I commend the NYPD for doing such a great job. And like we talk about crime, you can't allow a couple of hundred students to screw up the entire, the entire university system.
It was students, but now we know a good portion of the protesters or a portion of were outside agitators looking to influence, radicalize some of these students, teach them how to perform better tactics in regards to shutting down cameras, blocking doors, tactics. That's what's going on here, and it's a shame.
It's a damn shame. And my friend Congressman Estes was on the other day in the St. Louis University, the Washington University in St. Louis. Of the 100 people that were arrested, only 27 of them were students, and the rest of them outside agitators. And somebody's paying them. And I think that's the job of the FBI to find out who's paying these people.
Yes, and in part, this goes back to the BLM protest back in 2020. A lot of people arrested in New York City who were creating havoc weren't from New York City. And if you were not a student, you are an agitator. And to what degree that becomes, our intelligence division will let us know about that, but I couldn't agree more.
What is the status of these people? Were they arrested? Were they actually put in jail, or were they just given tickets?
So about 245 of them were given summonses. About 27 of them was a live arrest recall. They went through the system. That's for the burglary of the Hamilton House.
Yes.
And another 11 were given desk appearance tickets for criminal mischief. So it kind of ran the gamut. But again, a flawless performance. Nobody got hurt. There were two minor injuries for the protesters.
And I believe I've heard from some of the students, the regular students, that they commend the police for straightening out their school.
So it's funny you say that. There was about 2,000 kids that were in five dorms that we had to secure so they wouldn't come outside and maybe get hurt. And a decent majority, to your point, was saying exactly what you're saying, get them out of here, which was, I felt bad for those students because they were overwhelmed, but there was a voice in those students.
Thank you, Chief Shell. We'll catch up with you again real soon.
Thank you. I certainly will.
The Cats Roundtable.
With us this morning is Donald Klavan, Jr., and he is elected Hempstead Town Supervisor, and it's one of the largest towns in the country, I understand. Well, Mr. Klavan, I understand you're mad as heck over this congestion pricing, and you're going to sue the MTA. Tell us a little bit about it.
You know, and I appreciate the opportunity to come on. I listen to the show all the time. You hit it on the head. You know, we're the largest township in America with almost 800,000 residents. And what is taking place is literally it's a money grab by the MTA. This congestion pricing scheme where they're going to charge individuals traveling south of 60th additional fee to utilize the roads. It's nothing more than a money grab, and everybody knows it. But in the town of Hempstead, we have to stand up for our residents. You know, people who live in the town drive to the city. They're first responders, firemen, nurses, teachers. Some of these, you might have read recently, some of these great men and women were at Columbia University throwing protesters off of private property this week. And now you're adding a burden onto them. New York City and so a lot of our Albany legislators really truly believe that once you go past the Queens border, there's just endless amount of money in Nassau and Suffolk County, and there isn't. People work, day jobs, night jobs, husbands and wives to pay the bills, and we're at a breaking point here. And this pricing scheme, is just taking the money away. And we've initiated a lawsuit in federal court because we think it was done improperly. We think they violated both state and federal regulations, in particular that this should have gone before the federal government, particularly Congress. We are very, very confident. We're the first litigants on Long Island. We're joining lawsuits by Staten Island, by Monroe, and a couple of other areas. And we're hoping others will join our suit because we feel we will be victorious in the end because you are literally 2 months away from this money grab. And in Nassau County alone, on a yearly basis, 600,000 people travel to the city to work or even for medical treatment. There aren't any sort of exemptions for that. This wasn't taken into account. And everybody knows the MTA is an endless money hole. And this is just another attempt by them, to plug the SS Titanic of tax dollars.
I agree with you 110%. And you 800,000 people in the town of Hempstead, the largest in America. Wow, that's a big number. And I'm sure a lot of them travel to the city to see the doctors or whatever. Thank you, Donald Klavan, and we'll catch up with you again real soon. And you have our number. If you need anything, give us a call.
Thank you so much, and thanks for giving us the time. And residents, keep up the fight. Don't give in.
With us today is Borough President of Staten Island, Vito Fisella. He was a congressman before that. Vito Fisella, talk to us about it.
Well, good morning, John. Thanks so much, as always, for having me on. Appreciate it. There's going to be a big election coming in the next few months, and I think people are going to start to, if they haven't already, begin to see what's coming out of Washington, and it looks like a hodgepodge of insanity from time to time for people who just want to get their country back and back on track. And I think that's why you see so many folks think the country is moving in the wrong direction. It needs better leadership, stronger leadership, and some sanity. Just recently, for example, one of the top economic advisors to this administration really couldn't even explain how the money supply works. I mean, that's the essence of our fiscal system that drives interest rates, that drives whether you have inflation or deflation. And this is economic sort of 101, and they can't even get their arms around how the system works. And it's a little bizarre and borderline frightening that those are the folks who are making the decisions these days.
There is some lacking talent in Washington. People seem to get hired because of their sex or because of their, influence or not because of their talent. And the right thing to do is get hired because of your talent and your expertise.
Yeah, the one common thread that I think will stand the test of time is when you evaluate individuals on merit and their ability to perform and their ability to add value, whether it's in school, you know, they still give exams in schools and you get 100 and some kids get 70, right? And then you apply to college and some kids get in and some kids don't, and you apply for a job. And over time, you want to just be merit-based. That's the fairest, most equitable thing to do. And then what happens is you start to fabricate what's important and what's not, and you end up with bad results. So getting back full circle to Washington, D.C. these days, you know, we all live every day to day. You got to go to the grocery store and you're paying, you know, how much more than you were 3 years ago. You know, that's inflation. Just a couple of years ago, we were told, hey, it's just transitory. Don't worry about it. Now it's stuck, and inflation's going to come down. So what does the Fed do? They don't touch rates. Meanwhile, folks who wanted to buy a house can't afford it because mortgage rates are higher. This impacts every single American household, and these are the decisions made by folks in Washington that just don't translate to good policy, and it hurts. And it hurts in particular the middle class who see their dollars shrink or the value of their dollars shrink, in large part because people, I think, in D.C. have no clue what's going on in the ordinary household, whether it be on Staten Island or across the country.
Vito, I understand last week there was a lawsuit and some individuals won against New York City for, I think it was $3 million, because the person was fired and they hired somebody that was nowhere near his expertise, and because of certain favorites that were going on. And things like that are happening, and it's not right.
100%. You know, I just don't know, John, you're one of the smartest guys I know, one of the most successful business people, because I think, and I'm not going to put words in your mouth, you choose people and you're loyal to people who work hard, do the right thing, and try and bring value, whether it's to your business or the baseball team, whatever the case may be. And we try to instill that in our kids. Work hard, study hard, try your best. And if you do it, good things will happen. But then along comes these folks who just change policy and say, you know, the good guys go out. Merit doesn't matter. We got to check some boxes. And then we got to please other people. And I don't think it works. You know, see public companies that do that all the time. And what happens? Their share price drops because their obligation is to some fictitious proposal as opposed to what they should do is bring value to their shareholders. And I hope that the time comes that we can walk away from those things and get back to what really matters. Work hard, like the American way. Anything is possible in this great country if you work hard and do the right thing. Not if you just sort of manufacture stuff, because you're going to hurt some good people like the person you just mentioned who lost a job to somebody who was unqualified.
Vito Fisella, borough president of Staten Island, thank you so much, and we'll catch up with you again real soon.
Have a great one, John. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Cats Roundtable. We'll be right back right after this break. Welcome back to the Cats Roundtable. With us today is Joe Connor, and he wrote a column, Terrorists on Campus. Well, we know it's happening. And the other day, we did have Congressman Estes on talking about George Washington or Washington University in St. Louis, where 100 arrests were made, and only 27 of them were students. Who were the rest? Where were they flown in from, or where did they come from? Well, Joe Connor, you are concerned about this. You wrote that story. Tell us what you feel.
Thanks, John, and thanks for having me on. These universities have hired and pandered to terrorists for generations. For so many years, back in 2013, Columbia University hired Kathy Bodine. She was a member of the Weather Underground, a terrorist organization, and she was brought in as a celebrity to teach at Columbia. Previously, they had given a master's degree to Bill Ayers, another terrorist. At City College of New York, about 10 years ago, they had a student center named for Guillermo Morales and Asante Shakur, two terrorists. Morales was the bomber, the bomb maker for the FALN. And the connection here to me is that my father was murdered by the FALN. Morales was the chief bomb maker, blew his hands off in his Queens bomb factory on what would have been my dad's 37th birthday in 1978. He, with one finger, believe it or not, he escaped from Bellevue Hospital prison and ended up in Cuba, where he's been a guest of the Castros forever. And so we had
he's been a hero of the Castros, then.
A hero, a benefactor, a part of the Marxist regime in Cuba, along with Joanne Chesimard, who also escaped from prison, and others. And the kicker is my father studied at CCNY, yet they named a student center after his murderer. You know, the point that I was making in the column on townhall.com was that these universities have catered to and hired and celebrated terrorists for a long time. And what did they expect? What did we expect from this? I mean, I said on Megyn Kelly's show on Fox some years ago that, you know, if you went into the store and you bought food, you want to see what the ingredients are. Now you're sending your kid to university where you're spending $70,000. Don't you want to know what the ingredients are that your kids are getting out of that? Who's educating them? Who's indoctrinating them? And we're really seeing on these campuses now the rotten fruit of what has happened over the last decade or so.
It seems like, Joe Connor, it seems like Washington is for sale from foreign entities. Yeah. Our universities are for sale from foreign entities. I don't understand why the FBI doesn't do more, and they should do more. I mean, the CIA handles overseas, and the FBI handles domestic.
Well, you know, it's a really fine point. And I think what has happened over the last several decades is that the FBI has shifted. And we've all seen that, you know, the friends I've made in the FBI, and I've made many of them over the years with the work, because they were the ones who put the terrorists who murdered my dad in prison, and just great people. But most of them have retired. And instead of having field agents moving up in the ranks, obviously, we've seen lawyers, we've seen political appointees, party apparatchiks running the FBI. And what you get from that is you get this disaster where it's all been politicized. As I said before, my father was murdered by the wrong brand of terrorists. He was murdered by Marxist Puerto Rican terrorists. And these people now don't want to hear about that. They've been politicized. The FBI is not looking into what's going on here. If there was even an inkling of white supremacy, whatever even that even means, on these campuses, do you not think that they would have been taken down by now by either the NYPD or federal agency if they had the ability to do so? It's absolutely politicized, and the FBI has become a— Now, I don't want to mock the people I know, because they've just been so good.
Well, 99,
but at the top level of it, it's a disaster.
99.9% of the FBI people are great people, patriots, love
precisely,
America, and
precisely.
Do a good job. And the politically appointed ones in Washington have been able to get their way.
John, and we see it in everything in our society today, where people are being put in these jobs where they may not be the right fit, but they're the right— they say the right thing, or they look the right way. And things fall apart very quickly when you have incompetence or you have malfeasance at the top of the house. I mean, I testified in 2009 at Eric Holder's Senate confirmation hearing. You know, my father's murderers, the FALN members, aside from Morales, were given clemency by the Clintons. And one of them, Oscar Lopez, turned down the clemency, and Obama Biden gave him clemency on his last day in office. But I testified at Eric Holder's Senate confirmation hearing that in his role in the release of these terrorists, where he was the point person to Clinton.
Yes.
And my point was that anyone who would release terrorists would do anything. And now we see the DOJ would do anything. You know, it moves very quickly when you have bad actors at the top of the house. The rest of the house collapses. And this is
Joe
just symptomatic of that.
Stay on top of it, and let's talk more often. Thank you.
All right, John.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
Bye-bye.
The Cats Roundtable.
With us today is Steve Cates, otherwise known as Dr. Sky, and he takes our Sunday mornings and makes them a little bit brighter. And, well, Steve, tell us what's going on in the skies today.
Well, good morning, John. Happy May to everybody out there. Here's a couple of interesting stories, and I think an outstanding mystery of the week to come. We'll talk about the James Webb Telescope again. John, it's actually finding organic compounds in space, like ethanol, alcohol, acetic acid, and many other compounds swirling around protostars in the evolution of space. It's just totally amazing what this multi-billion-dollar spacecraft is doing. And it's so amazing, John, that we're finding things even as strange, how about this, as a lonely planet out in deep space with no star around it, 80 light years away, six times the size of Jupiter. Doesn't the stuff just get more interesting as we continue to explore it?
Is that part of our solar system?
Not at all. This is way out in deep space. This is like the first time an individual planet, imagine that, way out, we're talking about 80 light years away, and these objects are discovered by the high technology, not only of James Webb, but other telescopes. But what's odd about it, John, is how does the thing even survive if it's a planetary object? Most planets, of course, are around stars. So that's a really strange one, don't you think?
I do think it's strange. I mean, there's so many things going on out there that we have no clue about.
Well, here's something even more interesting. You and I love to talk about Mars. Well, here's something maybe people do not know. Dust storms on Earth, we know, can be major problems. Out here in Arizona, where I am, we get them in the summer, and they're pretty bad. But, John, on Mars, they tend to be global dust storms. Every three Martian years, Mars gets these dust and electrical storms with winds maybe higher than 70 miles an hour due to the lower pressure on the planet. But the dust on Mars, they say, gets into everything. It's like a magnet. So spacecrafts get covered, their solar panels. And obviously, they even have something even more bizarre, John. They have these large dust devils, like little tornadoes, that sail all around this amazing planet that hopefully someday humans will be able to explore and never know, maybe a future habitat for humanity, since maybe we all can't get along here on planet number three. What say you?
Well, that's... I think it's too far into the future to even consider it. Not in our lifetime.
Well, John, here's the mystery of the week. Now, this one's fascinating. You and I talked many times about navigation maps and how did they even know what the world looked like. But here it is. The question is this. How was longitude determined and who solved the problem? Well, the Greek scientist Hipparchos, as many might know, was one of the first to specify a coordinate system like latitude and longitude. But how did ships determine longitude at sea? Latitude at sea could be determined with the use of a sextant. We know that. But, John, longitude requires very accurate clocks, and there were none available in the early 1700s. So enter British carpenter, lockmaker, clock builder called a horologist, John Harrison, who responded to the British Longitude Act of 1714 to prevent sailors from using what they called dead reckoning or guessing where they were going. So Harrison developed, John, four clocks, but his best was known as the H4, a clock with accuracy, losing not but a few minutes over time. And he was looking at a prize. He didn't do it for the money. £20,000 was offered to the winner of this contest, but he never got the full amount. So I find it fascinating So to determine longitude, it's the time difference between Greenwich time and the time at sea with an accurate clock. So today, GPS obviously takes out the complexity of that. But, John, isn't that amazing? Here's a guy who was a carpenter and a clockmaker. I hate to use the word amateur clock builder. Look what he did, and he helped solve that problem. So now sailors could go and know where they were on the Earth because the Earth turns 15 degrees an hour. That's, to me, an amazing mystery of the week, don't you think?
Yes, it is. I mean, anything new with the moon? Now,
well, we can always say.
They are saying, right. What were they saying last week, Steve? They were saying that they wanted Musk to put down a ship next to where the Apollo landed.
Well, John, I mentioned this with Frank on the other side of midnight when we.
I must have been listening.
There you go. No, this is interesting. I'm saying there's nothing really too new to report on it, but here's my hope and probably a lot of other people. Anybody out there that doubts that we went to the moon, it looks like, you know, Musk is the leader in sending spacecraft. Send this high-technology 4K, 8K spacecraft. Just land it there, and that's once and for all. Let's see what Buzz Aldrin described. The flag fell over when they took off and all the other things there. That would be fascinating. But, John, I don't know why they haven't done it yet. That's kind of bizarre. We haven't been able to do that, or nobody's been pushing that. So maybe that's a message that's coming out through this particular show, the Cats Roundtable. Maybe Elon's listening. What do you think?
You never know. I mean, we do have a lot of listeners. And anything else we should look out for this week?
Well, we talk about the live sky, John. Tonight, Cinco de Mayo Day, of course, for many. But tonight, if you look into the southeast sky after midnight into Monday morning, a meteor shower called the Aquarid, you probably get to see 10 or 15 in dark skies, but it's all part of Halley's Comet if you never got to see it in 1986, and that's an interesting thing. But updates, John, always at WABCRadio.com with our popular Dr. Sky Experience podcast, where we give you all the fine details of what you can see in our skies. And always talk about American exceptionalism, John, and the other subjects about truth, justice, and the American way. It's always a privilege to be with you and the many listeners around the nation and the world on the Cats Roundtable.
Thank you, Steve Cates, and we'll catch up with you again real soon. Thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
If you ever miss a segment or want to hear it again, go to WABCRadio.com, go to podcasts, go to minicasts, and play back your favorite segment. Thank you for being with us for the Cats Roundtable Local Edition, the number one show on Sunday mornings in New York. Keep listening to us for the Cats Roundtable National Edition between 9 o'clock and 10 o'clock, so we'll be back to you in a few minutes after the news.